behavior and birding tips. So it's a quick and helpful read before a trip to find birds. For now, here are a few vocab words to get you started. The feathers on top of a bird's head are called the crown. Bird vocalizations come in two general types: songs, used to attract mates, and calls, with other meanings such as alarm or just, "Hey, I'm over here." The bright white lines found on many songbirds' wings are called wing bars. Like any language, the more you immerse yourself, the faster you'll learn. For Bird Note, I'm Jonice Franklin.
You're listening to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Today on Wings, the long struggle to abolish reproductive slavery.
Where is the precedent for the appropriation of a person's body by the state?
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
On February 15, 2023, Professor Dorothy E. Roberts delivered the 8th annual Francis Sissy Farenthold Endowed Lecture in Peace, Justice, and Human Rights. Professor Roberts holds appointments in both law and sociology at the University of Pennsylvania and is founding director of the program on race, science, and society in the Center for Africana Studies. Her talk was held at the Rothko Chapel in Houston, Texas, and was organized by the Bernard and Audrey Rappaport Center for Human Rights and Justice at the University of Texas at Austin School of Law. Here are excerpts from that talk.
In 1662, the Virginia Colonial Assembly had to decide the status of children born to black women and fathered by white men, men who raped enslaved women with impunity. The colonists made the political decision to give the children the status of their mothers. Now, this, of course, violated the patriarchal law of human inheritance, which gave children the status of their fathers. Instead, they followed the law that applied to animals. Piglets, for example, are the property of whoever owns the sow. You know, I've written about that law for a long time. I wrote about it in my very first Law Review article in 1991. And every time I think about it, I'm just awestruck by the magnitude of what that law did. It permitted white men to profit from raping enslaved women by enslaving any resulting children. It allowed them to enslave their own children. How could they enslave their own children? By classifying them as belonging to a different race. It erased kinship ties, and it helped to invent the lie that human beings are naturally divided into different races. Racism is so powerful, it can erase biology while pretending that it's biological. It allowed white men to profit from rape, and it also cemented the myth that black women's wombs are what create the disadvantage, the subordinated status of their children. I mean, just think about that. All of that is reverberating today. 2 centuries later, in 1860, Massachusetts Senator Charles Sumner would point to this legal entanglement of sexual assault, reproductive control, and white supremacy as the chief reason to abolish slavery. He declared before Congress that, quote, "the chastity of a whole race is exposed to violence, while the result is recorded in the telltale faces of children, glowing with the master's blood, but doomed for the mother's skin to slavery through descending generations. Captured all those aspects in that one sentence. The rights of family were central to the antebellum movement to abolish slavery. In petitions to the government, enslaved people often based their claims for freedom on the natural right to family integrity. Abolitionists also focused their condemnation of slavery on its immoral destruction of families. Family separation was inextricably tied to reproductive servitude. Enslavers had absolute discretion to buy and sell family members separately from each other. They could dismember black families at will for whatever reason. A 19th century South Carolina court noted that planters could sell children away from their mothers no matter how young. Newborns could be taken and sold away because, quote, the young slaves stand in the same footing as other animals. According to a historian, my colleague at Penn, Heather Andrea Williams, approximately one-third of enslaved children in the Upper South experience family separation. A slaveholder might sell a mother, a father, or their children to pay off a debt or to punish perceived disobedience. Black family members were devised in wills, wagered at horse races, and awarded in lawsuits. As Toni Morrison wrote in Beloved, enslaved women's loved ones routinely, quote, got rented out, loaned out, bought out, brought back, stored up, mortgaged, won, stolen, or seized. Nobody stopped playing checkers just because the pieces included your children. Even when enslaved families remained physically intact, black parents were denied authority over their children. Slavery law installed the white patriarch as the head of the extended plantation family. White people considered the plantation family, ruled by white men, to be the best institution to teach values to Africans, whom they deemed to be uncivilized. Law professor Peggy Cooper Davis writes, abrogation of the parental bond was a hallmark of the civil death the United States slavery imposed. Now, black mothers resisted reproductive slavery by self-inducing abortions, feigning illness, and fending off enslavers' sexual assaults. You may have read about the case of Celia, who was purchased in 1850 at age 14 by a white Missouri farmer named Robert Newsom, who bought her for the purpose of forcing sex on her. And he raped her on the way back from buying her to his farm in Missouri. After enduring 5 years of hell and pregnant with another one of his children, she clubbed him twice over the head, killing him. The judge in her murder trial instructed the jury that the law of self-defense didn't apply to chattel property. Celia was found guilty and hanged in 1855. In rare cases, as Toni Morrison fictionalized in Beloved, black women committed infanticide to protect their children from the horrors of slavery. But surely, enslaved women's greatest act of resistance was caring for their children. Yet their love for their children gave enslavers a cruel advantage. Slaveholders could threaten enslaved women who were rebellious with the sale of their children to make them more compliant. Enslavers used children as hostages to prevent bonded women from running away. Most enslaved women were unwilling to abandon their children in order to increase their own chances for escape. And most fugitive women took their children with them. So there's a long history of a white elite devaluing black mothers' relationships with their children, pretending that black women don't care about their children, while on the other hand, using the threat of child removal to control and punish black mothers because they do care for their children so much. And I'll have more to say about that later. Images of crying mothers and children clinging to each other as merciless slave traders wrenched them apart were widely circulated in anti-slavery pamphlets, slave narratives, and newspapers. The Reconstruction Congress was moved to draft the 13th and 14th Amendments, both by formerly enslaved people's heart-wrenching accounts of family separation and by the argument that the right to family integrity is inalienable. For example, Republican Senator James Harlan of Iowa advocated for the 13th Amendment by accusing slavery of causing, quote, the abolition practically of the parental relationship, robbing the offspring of the care and attention of his parents, severing a relation which is universally cited as the emblem of the relation sustained by the Creator to the human family. His colleague, Senator Henry Wilson of Massachusetts, promised accordingly, quote, when this amendment to the Constitution shall be consummated, the sharp cry of the agonizing hearts of severed families will cease to vex the weary ear of the nation. But the passage of the Reconstruction Amendments didn't end reproductive slavery or the struggle against it. We can fill out the trajectory of the foundational exploitation of enslaved women's reproductive labor with the history of policies punishing black women's childbearing throughout the 20th century.
On Wings, you are listening to excerpts from the talk titled The Long Struggle to Abolish Reproductive Slavery, delivered by Professor of Law and Sociology, Dorothy Roberts.
As I stated earlier, the first laws enacted in the colonies treated black women as innately unrapeable and their children as innately enslavable. This laid the foundation for long-lasting notions of black women's hypersexuality and hyperfertility and policies aimed at deterring black women from having children. The belief that black women passed down a depraved lifestyle to their children persisted even after the passage of the civil rights laws through the circulation of popular icons of black maternal unfitness, such as the welfare queen, who was portrayed as having babies just to get a welfare check and then spending all the money on herself while neglecting her children, or the image of a crack addict who gave birth to the supposedly monstrous crack baby. These stereotypes were buttressed by racist scientific research, such as Daniel Patrick Moynihan's 1965 report, The Negro Family, The Case for National Action, that blamed black matriarchs for the impoverishment of black ghettos. This mythology fueled harsh welfare and law enforcement policies, including mass sterilization of black women receiving welfare through federally funded social service programs. And these myths and policies are the subject of my 1997 book, Killing the Black Body. Of particular significance is the prosecution of black women for being pregnant and using drugs, launched during the war on crack in the late 1980s. Hospital staff routinely screen certain newborns for evidence of their mother's drug use during pregnancy and report positive results to child protection authorities. Over the last 30 years, states have increasingly included prenatal drug use in their definitions of child maltreatment. The devaluation of black women's procreation turned a public health issue into a crime. The contemporary parallels to black women's reproductive servitude during slavery continue with forced family separation. Many Americans view the child welfare system as a benign social service provider that safeguards children from abuse and neglect in their homes. But as I explain in my latest book, Torn Apart, this government regime is better described as a family policing system. It's a powerful state apparatus that intensively regulates the most marginalized communities in this nation by accusing family caregivers of child maltreatment, investigating and monitoring them, placing their children in the foster system, and permanently severing their familial bonds. Child protection agents gain their power to regulate families by wielding the threat of taking away their children. In 2020 alone, child protection agencies investigated accusations of maltreatment involving 3 million children. In cities across the nation, CPS, or Child Protective Services, surveillance is concentrated in impoverished Black neighborhoods, where all parents, all children, are ruled by the agency's threatening presence. Most Black children in America, 53%, will experience a CPS investigation at some point before they reach age 18. Okay, most Black children in America will experience an investigation for child maltreatment before they reach age 18. During CPS investigations, caseworkers typically inspect every corner of the home, and typically without any judicial warrant. They've been exempted from the Fourth Amendment, even though it applies to them. And they interrogate family members about intimate details of their lives. They may strip search children to look for evidence and collect confidential information from schools, healthcare providers, and social service programs. More disruptive still is the forcible family separation that too often follows CPS investigations. Most of the more than $30 billion spent on child welfare services goes to keeping children away from their families in foster care and adoption assistance rather than prevention and family services. More than 1 in 10 Black children will be taken from their families by their 18th birthday. Most children in foster care were removed from their homes based on accusations of parental neglect, which is defined as failing to supply, quote, the proper or necessary support for a child's well-being. And obviously, that is easily confused with poverty. Based on state child neglect laws, child protection investigators interpret conditions of poverty, such as lack of food, insecure housing, and inadequate medical care, as evidence of parental unfitness. And what's the remedy they provide? State agents force families into an onerous regimen of supervision that rarely addresses their needs. Parents who are unable to complete agency requirements in order to recover their children from foster care within an imposed time frame face termination of their rights. A judge permanently severs their legal relationship with their children.
In this next excerpt from her talk, Professor Roberts mentions two U.S. Supreme Court decisions. Roe, which legalized abortion as a matter of privacy in 1973, and Dobbs in 2022, which denies the Constitution protects reproductive rights and leaves the matter up to individual states.
Black feminists have long argued that reproductive freedom includes both bodily and family autonomy. We have developed a reproductive justice analysis that accounts for the entanglement of abortion bans, criminalization of pregnancy, and forcible child removal. The human right not to have a child, to have a child, and to raise a child in safe, supportive, sustainable communities has always been, from the very beginning, chief tenets of the reproductive justice framework. and it's a framework that is made more urgent than ever by Dobbs. By eliminating Roe's protection of abortion before viability, which some states considered at least a limitation on fetal abuse prosecutions, Dobbs has unleashed state power to criminalize pregnant people who fail to deliver a healthy baby. Women have been arrested both for stillbirths and for attempted abortions under the same fetal protection laws. Beginning with the 2001 homicide conviction of a black woman in Mississippi named Regina McKnight, who spent 8 years in prison until her conviction was overturned, for a stillbirth. Legal theories crafted to prosecute black women set the stage for more widespread criminalization for fetal harm. So by 2020, more than 1,700 women were arrested, detained, or subjected to forced medical interventions because of pregnancy-related outcomes and accusations. Over the same period, state legislatures enacted fetal protection laws that criminalized pregnancy by giving fetuses the status of already born children. I think we should consider the violence inflicted on black women by compelling their pregnancies under slavery to elucidate the violence inflicted on pregnant people today by compelling them to give birth under abortion bans. As historian Jennifer Morgan asked, where is the precedent for the appropriation of a person's body by the state? Where did we learn in this country that the state could define a fetus as a distinct matter of law and property and state intervention? We learned that from the long and violent history of hereditary racial slavery. Enslaved women's resistance against reproductive servitude also proves the Supreme Court's error in Dobbs. The Dobbs Court grossly misread the 14th Amendment and ignored its history by holding it provided no support for reproductive freedom. And as I already said, that was the reason, a central reason, for enacting the 13th and 14th Amendments to abolish reproductive slavery. Apparently, the court was unaware of that history. And to the contrary, the Dobbs decision will intensify the denial of family autonomy and destruction of family bonds that the Reconstruction Amendments were meant to eradicate. Especially telling is how the court's attention to adoption ties together the forms of reproductive oppression that are rooted in slavery, both compelled pregnancy and forced family separation. And during Julie Rickleman's argument on behalf of abortion clinics, Justice Amy Coney Barrett questioned, quote, insofar as you and many of you, your amici, focus on the ways in which forced parenting, forced motherhood, would hinder women's access to the workplace and to equal opportunities, it's also focused on the consequences of parenting and the obligations of motherhood that flow from pregnancy. Why don't the safe haven laws take care of that problem? Now, Justice Alito picked up this idea in his majority opinion. It didn't stay at the questioning during the oral argument. He recited, without any criticism, anti-abortion advocates' argument, quote, that states have increasingly adopted safe haven laws which generally allow women to drop off babies anonymously, and that a woman who puts her newborn up for adoption today has little reason to fear that the baby will not find a suitable home. That's a quote from the Dobbs decision. Okay, he then backed up this false claim with a footnote that quoted a 2008 CDC report. Quote, nearly 1 million women were seeking to adopt in 2002, i.e., they were in demand for a child. Whereas the domestic supply of infants, this is a quote from the opinion, a footnote. The domestic supply of infants relinquished at birth or within the first month of life and available to be adopted had become virtually non-existent. This vision of a well-functioning market for babies could not be further from the truth. First of all, it conveniently omits the physical and mental costs of gestating a fetus and the ethical problem of overriding pregnant people's autonomy over their bodies. The adoption market imagery falsely treats the decision to surrender the baby as if it were a freely made reproductive choice, when in reality it was coerced by the inability to get an abortion. But there's more that's so false about this baby market imagery. It terribly mischaracterizes how the adoption system operates. To begin with, the pain of losing a newborn is so severe that people who are denied an abortion rarely surrender their babies for adoption. When they were surrendered more often prior to Roe v. Wade, it was because they were forced to do it. You know, pregnant teenage girls were shipped off. It wasn't because they freely surrendered their babies for adoption. Instead, compelling people to give birth to a child whom they are economically, socially, or psychologically unprepared to raise intensifies the hardships faced by them and their families. And let's remember, will increase their odds of being deemed neglectful and becoming entangled in the family policing system. Adoption of children from foster care requires the termination of their parents' rights. The justice's promotion of adoption also ignores the untold number of what have been called legal orphans, severed from their families, but never adopted, abandoned by the state at age 18 or 21. And obviously, they're vulnerable to houselessness, poverty, and incarceration. Denying access to abortion will increase the numbers of children consigned to and spit out of the foster system without any family ties at all. We can unite the movements for reproductive justice, for prison industrial complex abolition, for abolition of the family policing system, under the banner of a shared vision of a caring and free society rather than a carceral society. We should connect activism to guarantee the legal right to abortion and all that's needed to actually be free from compelled pregnancy to the growing movement to dismantle family policing, led by parents and youth who have been ensnared in it. These activists promote legislation to end mandated reporting, to guarantee legal representation for parents, and to require informed consent for drug testing of pregnant people and their newborns. They advocate for policies that shift government funds away from coercive interventions in families toward putting resources directly in family caregivers' hands. And they are creating community-based approaches to support families and keep children safe.
Professor Dorothy E. Roberts holds appointments in both law and sociology at the University of Pennsylvania, and she is founding director of the Penn Program on Race, Science, and Society in the Center for Africana Studies. This Wings program was excerpted from the 8th Annual Francis Sissy Farenthold Endowed Lecture in Peace, Justice, and Human Rights. For a link to view video of the entire event, email wings@wings.org. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Karen Engel, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose books include The Gift in the Heart of Language, The Maternal Source of Meaning. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.